On this week's edition of New York Now, lawmakers were back in Albany this week while Governor Andrew Cuomo takes a trip to Georgia. Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins joins Karen DeWitt to talk about what happened this week and what's ahead.
We have the reality of the resources, and we need federal help.
But first, Karen joins us in studio to break down the news of the week. Then we have the last part of our series on women's suffrage in New York. This week, we'll look at what's happened since women won the right to vote. Plus, we'll take you to the state's canal system for a safe way to get out of the house this summer. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority will pass legislation.
We will pass a law prohibiting it, and we will take them to court challenging it.
Yet another stand for New York and sending a message to the nation.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. The state legislature returned to Albany this week to pass another round of bills they missed out on because of the coronavirus. Lawmakers cut sessions short this year when the pandemic started in March. They've been back a few times for various reasons, but have largely stayed away from the state capitol. Governor Andrew Cuomo, meanwhile, flew down to Georgia to lend a hand in that state's response to COVID-19, and he used the trip to criticize the federal government.
This has gone on much longer than it should have because of our politics, because of our division, because the federal government is in denial, and because of their incompetence.
That's, of course, not a new position for Cuomo. With me in studio to discuss that and more is Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio. Karen, thanks for being here.
It's my first time in the studio in 5 months.
It's the first time of anybody being in studio in 5 months.
Wow, so it's a debut. It's been a while, huh?
I know. So let's talk about the governor. Yes. He went down to Georgia this week to help that state with its COVID-19 aid. He's also on a rampage right now against the federal government, saying this has only gone on so long because the federal government hasn't taken similar actions as the state. And of course, he's calling on a federal executive order for mask wearing. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I don't think that you can argue that the federal leadership has not been good, that there's been mixed messages about should businesses open, reopen, should schools be closed, should they be forced to reopen even if some of them don't think it's safe. Very mixed messages on masks, with the president not being a fan of masks, to say the least. Until recently, he's kind of saying, yes, it's necessary in some cases. And if you look at what New York's done with the virus, we're more in line with the European countries, South Korea, Australia, who have, you know, fingers crossed, conquered the virus for now. And the rest of the country that didn't do all, you know, following the science like New York did, Florida, Texas, even California, they're in really big trouble right now. So I think Governor Cuomo, while maybe he says it too many times, like every day he talks about the feds, I mean, he's not wrong about it right now. Of course, we're not going to know until the pandemic's over someday, like who's right and who's wrong. But right now, it seems like New York, the European countries have done it the right way so far.
And the legislature was back in Albany this week, and they didn't act on any COVID-19 related bills because, as you said, and as our audience knows, the numbers in New York are down significantly. Mm-hmm. We're less than 800 hospitalizations, about 10 deaths every day, somewhere around there. So we're doing well. What bills did you notice that they passed this week? Was there anything huge that you had? I have a few here, but I'm curious to see what you were watching.
Yeah, please read them, because I was struggling to find any that, you know, rose to the level of reporting on, you know, while all this other stuff is going on.
There's like a few. What I noticed is they had some voting reforms that they passed, allowing expanded absentee ballot voting for the general election, like how they did in the primary, moved up the voter registration deadline to 10 days before an election instead of 25. There's also the Protect Our Courts Act, which I think was probably, from my perspective, be the biggest bill that they passed, which bars ICE arrests around state courthouses. And then
That was a big one.
Yeah, they did a moratorium on facial recognition technology in schools as well, which I think was targeted in Niagara County, but I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lockport City Schools, right.
Yeah, yeah. And we were talking earlier this week, and I think the bigger story here is what they were not doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, they never did their official end of session. So it's a lot of cleanup, a lot of tweaking bills. One that I noticed is they closed a loophole on fracking. Hydrofracking is banned in New York, but you could still dump hydrofracking waste. So that's significant. But in terms of, you know, what's going on with the pandemic, it's definitely under the radar screen. But they had to finish their session work at some point. And that's the big question. Are they going to come back or not to deal with some big elephants in the room, like the state budget deficit.
Right, that's the big thing. We're facing more than $13 billion in lost revenue because of the coronavirus. There's a huge deficit coming up. I mean, that's something that we haven't seen in years here, not since I think the governor took office. It was around that level.
Yeah, it was about $10 billion when he took office. So it's been a really long time since we've seen that. Yeah, and that, and as for reasons that we'll get into later in the show, they're hesitating on dealing with those big items that they're facing.
Yeah, like let's talk about marijuana legalization. That's a
well,
thought.
I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah, exactly. March, like in March, it was like a thought of, well, we could raise some revenue through marijuana legalization. Of course, we wouldn't realize it in a few years, but at least that would be there down the line. This week, there wasn't even a mention of it. It just seemed like they were coming back, and I think you're right, to just clean things up and leave, and if they have to come back to deal with the budget, they will.
Yeah, and in a way, like Governor Cuomo, just take the lead on all of this stuff and the blame or the credit for what goes wrong, what goes right.
Right, right. The emergency powers that he has don't expire until April. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats, as we'll hear, you interviewed Andrea Stewart-Cousins, the Senate Majority Leader. Mm-hmm. She says that he's really used the powers well, and she says the voters think that he used the powers well. But we'll get to that in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Cuomo also ruffled some more feathers this week. Last Friday, I think he put it down initially, but restaurants and bars now can't serve alcohol without food. And then there's all this confusion of, can I sell a side of chips with a drink, or does it have to be a full meal? I mean,
that seems like that's all that anybody's talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's because people want to get out. They're just tired of being shut up inside, and the virus is low here. I think people don't see the threat as much as they did, and it is very confusing. How do you regulate that? The governor says he never allowed outdoor drinking, but that wasn't clear when he did, you know, ease the rules and
I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
I think they did allow outside drinking.
They didn't specifically say no. That's my recollection. When it was phase two or phase three and it reopened, it was more, you know, outdoor dining, and you would think that would mean you could go up to the bar, but then apparently it's got out of hand because too many people went up to the bar and they started congregating. You know, you have a couple of drinks and you just kind of forget about all those pesky rules, you know?
And I know people that work at bars here in Albany, and I asked them several times, like, are you sure that you can reopen? And they're like, yeah, we have guidance and everything.
Yeah.
Before I have to let you go, because we have your interview with Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, give me the key takeaways that you had from that interview before we take a look.
Well, you know, I think, as always, she's very poised. She's really a good leader for the Senate, and but I think that she's also pretty careful about what she says in terms of, you know, she knows that she's got to guide this, and right now she's you know, also walking through, you know, some pretty tight waters.
Yeah, you guys talk about a lot of things. Let's take a look at that interview.
Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, so nice to talk to you again.
It's always good to speak with you, Karen.
Now, as we're speaking, you're going to have a few days of the legislature meeting. You're already at the Capitol. You're going to go into session. Is this it for 2020? Are you going to be gone after this week for good?
No, Karen, it's not going to be like that at all. You know, our reality is that there is nothing normal about this session. Our session technically ended on June 2nd, and obviously it has not. And it hasn't because there's still a lot to be done, and we are wanting to be as nimble as possible to continue the work that people of New York expect us to do. So we are doing a lot in order to continue to make sure that New York is working, that it's working well, and of course we are still you know, having hearings and expect to come back as the budget unfolds and, you know, on the congressional level.
Yeah, well, we'll get to the budget in a moment. We reporters have been hearing a lot from advocacy groups with a lot of measures. One is called the Cancel Rent Movement, which would suspend rent payments until the pandemic's over. Others think the wealthy should be taxed. Wondering if any of those issues are going to be addressed this week.
Well, we are, you know, obviously very proud of what we have done in terms of tenant protection and rent, and we are as concerned as everyone and how this is going to unfold. But the reality is that we are still doing things. We passed legislation, as you know, it just started last week, the Emergency Rent Relief Act, where you know, our lowest income New Yorkers can get subsidies for their rent so that no one will be evicted. Obviously, there's an eviction moratorium. We also have legislation that stops utilities from cutting off their, you know, gas and electricity and telephone. So we are continuing to work with New Yorkers to keep them in their homes and try and figure out a path forward.
Do you think what you're doing in that is enough? Because it does seem like there's a terrible housing crisis looming if things don't get better soon.
There is a terrible housing crisis, and we are trying to figure out every way possible to make sure that New Yorkers we're all suffering. We are all suffering, so we want people to stay in their homes, and we're trying to figure out ways to make sure that happens. We have the reality of the resources, and we need federal help. We need federal help in terms of housing, because this is happening all over the country, you know, and unless we get federal help, we will not be able to help New Yorkers in the way that we know they need to be helped.
Well, the elephant in the room, of course, is the state budget deficit. At last count, I think it's about $13 billion, if not more. Governor Cuomo is threatening to make 20% cuts to schools, local governments, healthcare if the feds don't act. So I guess I can take it that you won't be acting on the budget this week. I know that you're waiting for the federal government to act, but it just seems like time's running out. They've got to act soon. And what happens if they don't give enough aid?
Well, I understand that they are acting, you know, I want to obviously from the last go round when we were trying to do the budget, Senator Schumer was extremely helpful, as was Senator Gillibrand, in making sure that state and local governments got the resources to at least stave off some of the worst that could happen. Now, our congressional delegation has advanced what they call the HEROES Act, which would be extraordinarily helpful for all of us in all of these categories.
Right, that's what that's what the Democrats want, right? But the Republicans in the Senate have to go along with it.
They have to go along with it. And from what I gather, there is some conversation now, because as COVID rages throughout the nation, everybody, I think, is being hit one way or another with the incredible expense in every way of COVID-19. So I understand that the Senate is beginning to talk. Obviously, it may not be what the House has put forward, but the dire need for all of us, especially here in New York, we were so very, very hard hit, has got to be topmost in everyone's mind. So we expect we'll be back. We expect we'll have to deal with our issues, but it will be a lot easier to deal with if we have some real help from our federal partners.
Right. Back in March, the legislature granted Governor Cuomo a number of extraordinary powers, and he's used them to shut down schools, shut down businesses, make everybody wear masks. I'm wondering, looking back, if there's any powers that you regret giving him, or if the legislature went too far.
No, I think you remember, as we all do, those days in March where all of a sudden we were hit and we acted extremely quickly under the circumstances, and we understood we had to be nimble. And, you know, I think that, the governor has done an extraordinary job with making sure that, you know, we're in this place now where people are looking to us and to the things that we did. And all the things you said, wearing a mask, shutting down, so on, we did. So, no, I think New Yorkers agree that the governor has handled the powers extraordinarily well. We are not done with this pandemic. I think, as you and I were speaking even before we got to share with the audience, you know, the fact that the nation is on various stages of the virus or shutdown or fighting about masks, and we are a very small country. And so at any given time, although we're doing well, if we lose our guard, if we let our guard down, we could be in trouble again. So I don't think that's our issue now. I think our issue is staying safe and trying to build on what we've gotten.
And finally, looking ahead to August, the Senate and Assembly are going to have hearings on the nursing homes. What, if anything, went wrong. As you know, over 6,000 residents died. There was a controversial March 25th directive by Governor Cuomo that said nursing homes had to take back residents who were COVID positive. What do you hope to learn from the nursing home hearings?
Well, we're going to look at, I will say that that's going to be one of so many different hearings because COVID impacted every piece of our lives. Well, we're going to be looking at the mortality rates. We're going to be, looking to see what we should learn from what's happened and how should anything like this threaten us again. We will be prepared. What do we need to know? What do we need to learn? And obviously, I think those hearings, all of them, will give us a great deal of insight as to how we performed and what we might do going forward.
So do you view that in any way as an adversarial hearing?
No.
With the governor's people? Because I know your Senate Health Committee chair has been a bit critical of some of the ways the nursing homes were handled.
You know, I like to take hearings for what they are, which are hearings. You know, we ask questions, we get the appropriate people around the table who will give us testimony and insight. And like I said, this what we want to do is, to do our jobs and to do them as well as possible. And we want to learn from whatever we can learn from and make sure that we are poised to take care of anything like this going forward. And like I said, there were so many things to learn. And so this is an opportunity. It's a hearing, and we will be listening.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. I'm sure a lot of people will be tuning into those hearings. Thanks very much for giving us your time. I hope that we'll talk again soon.
I hope so. Thank you.
We'll have an extended version of that interview online. Now turning to the last part in our series on women's suffrage in New York. Last week, we told you about what happened right after women won the right to vote in the U.S. This week, we're looking at what's happened since. Misara Makati has the story.
Popular culture paints a portrait of the post-war years in the U.S. as an era of domestic tranquility. In reality, activism was alive and well. The 40s and 50s set the stage for a fundamental shift in the U.S. political landscape.
So the 1960s, women were still operating in a kind of severely patriarchal society in both their kind of professional and personal lives. Women, specifically Black women, were fighting against racial discrimination, specifically around social inequalities, such as housing, education, labor, and political representation.
The vanguard of the growing feminist movement was the National Organization for Women.
A hallmark of the women's movement was a kind of impatience, warranted impatience. Now that we're here, if we don't do it now, who's going to do it? The National Organization for Women came out of frustration at not getting their agenda seriously considered by those in government. Promises made, promises not kept.
New York saw an increase in the participation of women in politics. Women took up the challenge. In New York, the daughter of Jamaican immigrants began an old-fashioned rise up the Democratic Party machine.
Shirley Chisholm is what we consider a daughter of Brooklyn. She does not get involved in politics because of some ideological yearning. There wasn't a watershed moment that was happening in the United States or New York. Her entry into Brooklyn politics really comes as a concerned constituent.
Chisholm entered politics to improve the lives of the people in her Brooklyn neighborhood.
She's a volunteer. She decides to do the work that most women were relegated to do, which was stuffing envelopes and canvassing and doing fundraising, and did all of that kind of work. But then it became quite clear to her that African American women never had leadership positions.
Chisholm was determined to make a difference. In 1965, she won election to the New York State Assembly. She advocated for a higher minimum wage, better access to daycare, and extension of unemployment benefits to domestic workers. Issues of importance to her constituents. In 1969, she leveraged her political skills and connections to become the first Black woman to serve in Congress. In Washington, she continued to prioritize the social reform issues that she championed at the state level. Her staff was entirely female, and half of them were Black women. And in 1971, she became a founding member of the National Women's Political Caucus to encourage and prepare more women to run for office. In 1972, Chisholm became the first Black woman to seek a major party's presidential nomination. It was deeply symbolic for the nation and New York.
And so for Shirley Chisholm to run for the presidency, to try to formulate a coalition of marginalized people was very difficult. People were not ready for an identity politics to operate in a specific way, specifically coming from the body of a Black woman.
Chisholm finished far behind the eventual nominee, but her 1972 campaign raised issues of importance to communities of color and to women. After her presidential run, she continued her work in Congress for another 10 years. She returned to education and continued to mentor a new generation of New York political leaders. In the years that followed, women from across the New York political, racial, ethnic, and geographic spectrum became politically active.
It is normative now. It is not unusual to see a woman running for office. And that's a great thing to be able to say.
It has only been 100 years since women won the right to vote. In that time, many women served as local officials and many served in the state assembly and Senate. New York women serve in the United States House of Representatives and the Senate. It is an incredible record built on the work of many women who refuse to give up on the idea of social, civic, and gender equality. It is a great New York story and one with no end in sight.
You can catch our full series on Women and the Vote online at WMHT.org. Before we let you go, New York's canals are now open for the summer and offering some safe, socially distant fun. Think of places like the historic Erie Canal or the Champlain Canal. A lot of people who live here don't realize everything the state's canal system has to offer. I spoke with Brian Stratton from the Canal Corporation.
Well, the Erie Canal and the New York State Canal System is a engineering marvel. When it opened in 1825, it transformed our state and the nation in terms of trade, travel. It was absolutely phenomenal. This is a absolutely unique system, and it spans seven of the state's 10 economic development regions. So there are great opportunities for tourism, recreation, biking, hiking, and really that's what we're going to be seeing more of as the Reimagine the Canals program begins to unfold. And so what we're doing this year is really encouraging people to stay within their own neighborhoods, within their own region, and utilize this marvelous system, which is really naturally custom made for social distancing and for safe vacationing. So we have partnered with local businesses regionally here in the Capital Region, in Syracuse, in the Rochester Finger Lakes region, and in Buffalo, Lockport, and the Tonawandas with trail biking programs and with also kayak and canoe programs. So in cooperation with local businesses, individuals or families can plan an absolutely free vacation and experience the wonders of our canal, also learn about its great history and how it formed New York State. Here in the Capital Region, we have Paddle Pedal the Mohawk, which is a combination kayak and bike trip. Upstate Kayaks is there to be able to offer you the opportunity to kayak from Mohawk Harbor in Schenectady down what is the path of the Erie Canal along the Mohawk to Niskayuna's Aqueduct Park. And from Aqueduct Park, you can get out of your kayak. They will take your kayak from you and put you on one of the green CDPHP bikes, and you can pedal along the Empire State Trail, Erie Canalway Trail, all the way back to Schenectady. It's probably about an 8-mile trip. We also have trips similar to that within the Rochester Finger Lakes region along the West Genesee River and the Erie Canal for the beautiful communities of Pittsford, Parenton, Fairport. And then we go all the way west to the Buffalo region, to the Tonawandas, and to Lockport. So really, there's a great opportunity for everyone to get out on the canal. It's important for folks to get out, to be able to get out of the house. I mean, we've been shut in for months now. And so if they have a safe opportunity where they can have masks on or stay within 6 feet or greater, then we're able to really enjoy all that this great New York State Canal System has to offer.
That does it for this week. Thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.